Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Shafiq Khan to the broadcast. Shafiq is the president and founding partner of Teach the World Foundation, a nonprofit that seeks to enhance global literacy using digital technology. Prior to founding Teach the World, Shafiq was the senior vice president of channel strategy and distribution at Marriott International, where he was responsible for leading all of Marriott's distribution channels, growing them from $150 million in revenue to an excess of $15 billion in revenue. Shafiq received his MBA from Harvard Business School and an economics degree from Punjab University in Pakistan. In this interview, Shafiq shares how he's leveraging his experience as a digital pioneer to establish and deploy models of literacy and learning effectively and at scale through the power of digital technology. Globally, 2 of every 7 people are functionally illiterate, and Shafiq argues that traditional models of education can't effectively close the gap, especially in the developing world. He believes digital technology can democratize education to benefit not just the individual receiving it, but the global economy as a whole. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World Class IT is brought to you by Transmit Security. Transmit Security designs and develops platforms that address problems in security and usability by making it easy for developers to implement advanced authentication techniques ranging from biometrics to behavioral profiling. As the risk of cyber attacks and hacks increase, companies need a more effective way of preventing unauthorized access. I recently caught up with the Transmit Security CEO, Mickey Budai. This week, Mickey shares his belief that the strength of the team is the most important factor when choosing a vendor, regardless if the vendor is a startup or a well-known company.
The last recommendation is about vendors. So many companies and vendors are trying to win your business. Choosing the right one to work with is a bit challenging. Should it be a startup or a large known vendor? Should it be company A or company B? Over the past decade, I've been an active investor in more than a dozen startups. I've learned that my most successful investments were when the core team was super smart. It had nothing to do with the market size or how cool their idea was. It was all about how smart the team is. Because when the team is smart, they would figure out the market and the product and read the field correctly and eventually succeed. When the team is not the smartest, a big market and a good idea is just not good enough to succeed. I believe that the same logic applies when choosing a vendor to work with. If you have a project and let's say 5 different vendors to choose from, assess the people and choose the smarter team. For the long run, they are the most likely to succeed in your environment. Ask to meet with the product leader and the head of development for the solution that you're looking for. Ask which team was the most impressive in terms of knowledge during the POC. Whether this is a startup or a large vendor, it doesn't matter. There are obviously other factors you should look at, but my suggestion is to look at the strength of the team as the most important factor.
Tune in next week when Mickey discusses the management of in-house legacy systems. Shafiq Khan, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you very much, Peter. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. Shafiq, I thought we would begin with your current role. You are the founder and the chief executive officer of Teach the World Foundation. And I wonder if you could take a moment to describe the foundation and its mission.
All right. So in a very macro sense, our vision is to enhance human potential by increasing knowledge and learning, specifically by increasing literacy. As many of us probably already know, that 2 out of 7 people in the world are not functionally literate, and that is a huge cost for the world. Given that, when we decided we wanted to work on something using our digital background to have social impact or have an impact on the world, we decided our focus was going to be on increasing or enhancing human potential. And then to translate that into a more specific mission, our essential mission is to establish and deploy effective and scalable, and the key word is scalable, models of literacy and learning. And by and large, doing that by leveraging the power of digital technology. Now, we all know that digital technology has had massive impact in, I mean, everything, every domain, right? Our world has changed as a result of digital technology. But to a large extent, it hasn't happened effectively enough in the educational space, in the learning space, probably because it's a nonprofit space. It isn't a very competitive space from that perspective. And so digital technology hasn't been leveraged there. So our mission in trying to deploy an effective and scalable model of literacy and learning is to essentially prove to the world that we have a new way of learning that will address two very, very significant problems the world has. One of them is really a problem with literacy in general. As I said, 2 out of 7 people in the world are functionally illiterate and therefore potentially not contributing to the world, potentially a drag on the world, and therefore to all of us, on all of us. And the other is not a problem as much as the fact that we have the opportunity of leveraging digital to improve learning, and we're not really doing that so far, but we now have the opportunity to do so. So when we look at what we are doing here with regard to leveraging digital for learning, we have a phenomenal story here. And in fact, it's not even a single story, it's multiple stories. So clearly, with regard to Teach the World, the story is about using digital and leveraging digital to create a revolution in literacy, and ideally, in the Nirvana scenario, get the 2 billion out of the 7 billion people who are in the world who are functionally illiterate to become literate. Yeah, it might take a few decades, but if you decide you're going to do that, there is now a solution. So that is a very significant revolution for the world. And that's a fantastic story, getting 2 out of 7 people to be more productive because they're now functionally literate. But that's only one part of the story. An even larger story is that if you believe that digital will enable learning in a way that cannot happen before today, and if this learning is enabled and moved into a new paradigm. So the current paradigm is a push paradigm where all of us are largely learning because a teacher is pushing content and knowledge to us. The new paradigm that digital allows and enables is self-learning and learning by doing. So the moment you start to move to that paradigm, learning just improves dramatically. And in our particular case, we've found that with self-learning, with far less time, our children are learning more than they would learn through the push medium. And now, if you do this to improve learning in the world, the application of it is to schools. The application of this is to training. The application of it is for vocational training. And my belief in this is that that is the big revolution. If we believe that all human progress is a function of learning, and yes, we've seen that in history. You know, the printing press alone created this revolution in learning just because of the dissemination potential that the printing press created. The internet and what the internet has allowed, enabled to happen. But now having digital tools that allow you to do 2 plus 2 digitally without, by doing it, by actually learning by doing, is incredibly powerful. And to me, again, if learning is enhanced by even 1%, one percentage point, you know, it's in 33 years, the learning of the world would double. It would be better, double what it would have been otherwise. And that's huge. If we had had an improvement, an enhancement in learning 1,000 years ago, that was at that scale, we would have been in 2018, 200 years ago. So while it's a very abstract thought, the fact is, the larger story is that this self-learning paradigm that is going to be enabled by digital that just couldn't be handled by the analog practices of the past, just because it was not physically possible, is the big story.
And Shafiq, I'd like to ask you about the genesis of the idea.
I should mention here at the outset that you have a long and illustrious career in the private sector with global businesses like United Airlines, U.S. Airways. You spent more than a decade and a half at Marriott, where you were Senior Vice President of E-commerce, also the Senior Vice President of Channel Strategy and Distribution. As such, you helped grow what was an early stage digital footprint, let's so to say, into a $12 billion business within a larger business. So very, very significant digital e-commerce operation for Marriott. And so you bring a lot of experience to the table in what you've described. But I'm curious, how did the idea occur to you as you were looking to pivot from your private sector career to this new, very important segment of your career? How did you arrive at the idea?
Well, you know, once you start in digital, where I actually did start accidentally because I was given a problem to solve, and the solution happened to be online booking, which is all powered by digital, and electronic ticketing, which is all powered by digital. And since we in travel began very early, even pre-internet, so in our case, we started in the early 90s, you sort of become a digital pioneer, and then you become a digital student as a result. And you're sort of looking at what else is playing out, what you're doing, how you're doing versus other industries, and so on and so forth. And by the grace of God, we did very well. Well, it's still the largest sector on the internet. The last time I looked, it was by far the largest sector in terms of 30 to 35% of all internet sales being on travel. But once you're in that mode and you find that digital is having implications for travel, for banking, for retailing, you start to look at where else might it have its next manifestation or the biggest manifestation. And, you know, it didn't take very long to realize that the biggest manifestation of digital could be in enhancing learning. And that, to some degree, frankly, occurred serendipitously. I come from Pakistan, a very poor country where a lot of people are illiterate. We had started a foundation in Pakistan that was teaching children who were on the street, picking children on the street and, you know, taking them to school. So we're now at about 115 children that we are effectively educating. But in the process, you know, you just get introduced to the scale of the problem. While it's very gratifying to be serving or changing the lives of 115 children, the fact is there are millions and millions and millions, and we just talked earlier about the 2 billion population in the world. In Pakistan alone, the number is 20.5 million, a very large population that was out of school. And so I started to think about it as a problem that we needed to solve. We need to figure out a way to solve it. And serendipity works in many ways. So I ran into my partner, Imran Saeed, who's a professor at MIT at Sloan. And he was thinking of the same thing, education and the impact of digital education. And his focus was on the US, and mine was more Pakistan. But we began to start our thinking together about 6-7 years ago. And about 5 years ago, we landed on the concept that we now have. that we felt could really provide a solution to illiteracy in developing countries. And so that's the sort of the driver. Once we landed on the concept, we both basically told our companies that we would be leaving at a certain point in time. In my case, I announced my departure 3 years before I left at Marriott. And Marriott is such a great company that they were absolutely fully supportive of this move. So the genesis then was really the fact that I had a digital background, was looking for something that would be bigger, would have greater social impact, and then it happened to be education, and here we are.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about the methods that you have used. I know it is still early days, but I also know from our past conversations that you've had a chance to explore this far enough to see what's working and actually develop some really exciting strategies that you even have data to prove their worth. And I wonder if you can share some of that with us.
Sure. Absolutely. So the first thing was, what is the model? So when I say we have a model that could provide a solution to the illiteracy problem in the world, so partly it's defining the problem. And the biggest part of the problem is the shortage of teachers. So there are many, many, many places that just don't have teachers. An example is one of the places we are operating in, up in the Himalayas at 10,000 feet, where there's no electricity, no internet connectivity, in hardly any roads and so on. Anybody who's educated just leaves. So there is no teacher. There are no teachers. There are people who still live there, and there are children who are still, you know, sort of living there, not going to school. So so we said, all right, the problem is the lack of a teacher. I said, good. How would you teach a child without a teacher? And that's where the digital, you know, the power of digital, leveraging existing digital, came into play. We have online curriculums already deployed in the world. In fact, we have these MOOCs that are huge. The thing is, right now, they're focused on primarily higher education. Could online be brought down to the kindergarten, the K-5 type levels? Absolutely. So we said, all right, that's one thing we need to do. Well, how do you deliver that? What are the interfaces and engagement mechanisms you use? Well, tablets have arrived on the scene around 2011. And all of a sudden, we were finding that everywhere in the world, the smallest child was able to negotiate their way around a tablet and play with a tablet. So we said, let's have this online curriculum and put it on a tablet. And then the final thing was, all right, so you do that. If there's no teacher, what do? How do you motivate them to study and to use this? And that's where the concept of gamifying curriculum came in. So at the K-5 level, it is possible to turn everything into a game. And so you learn your ABCs through a game. You learn your 2 + 2 = 4 = 4 through a game. And so we combined the three elements, online curriculum delivered on tablets in a gamified format. And that became our model. The next step for us was, so good, we all sort of believed, me and my partner and many others that we consulted with and that became part of our sort of team, we all believed, but we needed to prove it to ourselves. So we developed a plan, and then we had to have a plan for what are we going to do long term. So essentially developed a relatively simple three-step plan or three-phase plan. Phase one was, let's prove the concept to ourselves. So let's deploy in a proof concept mode somewhere, find the right kind of setting, and then see what impact does it have and whether our concept really works. So that was phase one. If we succeeded in phase one, our plan was to do the next phase, which was, fine, we've proven that the concept works with one proof of concept in one location, but that isn't really evidence that it can scale. So the second phase is proving that it can scale and scale significantly. So our target was at least 50 replications of what we were doing in the proof of concept in the second scaling phase. And then that would lead to the third phase. So while we were doing the second phase, we would also invite what I call the Global Educational Funding Establishment, which is pretty much the World Bank, USAID, the governments of various countries, the many foundations that basically feed education all over the world. And so we basically decided that in the second phase, we would bring them in, not necessarily as funders, but primarily as people who were watching what we were doing, in some ways, sitting on an observation deck, seeing what we were doing with the scaling of this new concept, and then essentially persuading them that if what they found was successful, then they take us to this third phase, which would be global expansion. And the global expansion would have, let's say, the World Bank writing a check for education to Sierra Leone, specifying that a certain part of that funding needed to go into illiteracy, into this new model, and so on. So that's the plan we made, and that is what we are implementing. In terms of other aspects of the model, we just decided we were going to be focusing on children. We were going to take the line of least resistance in general in terms of deployment, meaning we would try as far as possible to deploy in school-like settings or even schools that were not fully utilized. Unfortunately, even in the poorest of countries, the vast majority of schools are used for a single shift. So in our model, we basically try to leverage existing infrastructure to the maximum we can possibly do. And that essentially led us into a set of pilots with a number of entities, and we're now running 6 pilots in 6 different geographies. With by the end of the year, a number that will be somewhere around 1,200 children.
That's remarkable, Shafiq. Can you talk a bit about some of the results?
Yes. So the results, interesting. So when I started the game, this a key part of what we're doing is measurement, because if you don't measure the results, you don't know if it works. So a key part was measurement, and it had to be third-party measurement because we can't be evaluating ourselves. We are already too vested in this belief that this concept works. So with the proof concept, we hired Nielsen, the U.S. company, and had them be our third-party independent measurement mechanism, research mechanism. And what they did was they established a control group, and then we had our own intervention group, the one that we were teaching digitally. And one of the questions they had for me was, what does success look like? And I said, well, my group is only going to be taught using tablets without any instruction. The other group is going to be taught in a regular classroom with a regular teacher who's there to assist and aid and all that stuff. So given that, if my kids scored half as well, I would be happy. And that's what we decided as our success metric. The results were astoundingly good. In fact, our kids did 2 to 2.5 times better against the control group that was getting the traditional education. And so we were obviously very, very, very pleased. Subsequently, we have now 6 pilots, and we have results for 3 of them already. the three newer ones that we don't have results for yet. But the results for all three of the pilots have been very significantly similar. And these are actually in different geographies. So one of them is in Karachi, where the original proof of concept was, in a different school, but in Karachi. Another is at the foothill of the Himalayas at 10,000 feet. A third is in a refugee camp in Dhaka, Bangladesh. So the geographies and the settings couldn't be more different, but the results are almost identical. And in each case, two to three times better than the control group we measured against. So we are very, very, very pleased with these results. And I would also add that at this point, everything that we have, the hardware, the software, even our own approaches on implementation and deployment, they're really very early stage. So these results are good, dramatically good today. 5 years from now, when you would be able to personalize the curriculums, when you'd have to have, when you'd have hardware that was specifically designed for education, when you had games that were made for these environments and that had, that were localized and then personalized, you would get probably significantly better results. So we are very gratified with the results we've seen so far.
Yeah, it's amazing. We hear of so many startups that in their early iterations, through all the planning and good ideas that arise, often have to pivot because they are met with the reality of the marketplace, which suggests that something is off. And it's very exciting to hear this idea, Shafiq, of the idea that you put out there and then surpassed the mile markers that you were and the goals and metrics that you put out to define success. It really, in many ways, is already proving the model, especially when you take into consideration the diversity of geographies, the different people that are involved. I should mention also, you've mentioned to me, it's not as though you are taking intellectually gifted children. This is does not discriminate in terms of one prior to this, their ability to learn either, if I remember correctly.
No, actually, you're absolutely right. We actually took kids from, in the proof of concept, these were kids on the street. These were actually kids in a community that had school, but couldn't really afford to go to school and couldn't afford the $2.50 that it cost to go to school. And so we picked them off the street, and my God, we got incredible results, including at least one of the kids we found was a genius. And this is another thing about digital. You're able to actually serve the needs of the entire class. In a typical class, 80% of the kids are sort of in the middle, 10% are slow, 10% are much further ahead of the rest of the class. And at the end of the day, both have a problem. The smart kids get bored and make trouble. The slow kids have struggled to keep up and generally then continue to be further and further behind the class as the class moves on. In this case, with digital, that's another major, major benefit. And by the way, we found, as in the case of digital in general, my entire experience with digital, I have found that everything that we estimated was beaten by a factor of 4 to 5. Adoption was greater. The adjacencies were significantly greater. In most cases, frankly, we didn't even forecast them. When we were launching online booking for the airlines, I was actually only thinking about online booking. I wasn't thinking about check-in, which is for many people, that's a lifesaver. I wasn't thinking about electronic boarding passes. I wasn't thinking about running the entire loyalty program digitally. We were actually starting with booking, and that's all we were thinking about at that point. But everywhere you find that the benefits are often way more than what you'd originally planned. And I have become a believer now that they're always going to be, ideally you get the core right and you get the core benefit that you want, but there's much more. In our case, just to amplify that point, so while our original intent was primarily to make sure that we could teach children who didn't have access to teachers, a huge benefit we found very quickly was that even children who were being taught in the developing world by poor teachers, because there are very many not very well-trained teachers, were now learning a lot more. So all of a sudden, there was this massive democratization of education happening with kids in very poor schools, with poor teachers now being at parity with kids in rich schools where the teaching staff was significantly more qualified. So huge democratization benefit and huge equalization benefit. Another thing we found was, again, serendipitously, we had initially decided that we wanted to worry about screen time, not because we had any evidence that screen time at the 3 to 4 hour level for children was bad. We had no evidence, but we sort of thought we should be careful about it. So we limited our class time in school day to 2.5 hours. But our kids, all the results that I'm telling you about are about kids in 2.5 hours a day outperforming kids who had a 4.5 hour day. So, you know, these benefits are the benefits that I hadn't even thought about. And beyond that, one of the other benefits that I'm seeing here in all the pilots that we've done is everywhere, universally, children who are self-learning are actually just seem to have a level of confidence that is different from that of a kid who's being educated in the traditional mode. And this is, we're seeing this in spades. It's not obviously objectively measurable at this stage, but again, the teachers that we are talking to are all telling us that this is one of the more dramatic things they're seeing.
And I wonder, you know, it's interesting as you talk about the gains in confidence that these children are showing. It highlights actually the downstream effects of good education on the functionally illiterate that you were referring to. The potential for economic gains, the reduction in crime, the lifting more boats, more children, and more families out of poverty. You know, as you think about the kind of downstream effects, those and others, I would love for you to maybe take a few moments and reflect on some of what you're hoping might result, more broadly speaking, based on the progress that this is showing.
Yeah, so very clearly, we know that the correlation between education and progress, education and economics, it's almost a perfect correlation, right? We see that. So our belief is that if we're going to educate millions more people to make them functionally literate, if the world were a family of seven and two people were illiterate and you made them literate, the entire family, the world in this case, would benefit. And so not only would the individuals benefit because they would be able to, you know, operate a computer, read the newspaper, be able to understand a lease, understand a mortgage. Their life would change. But beyond that, the skills that they would learn would allow them to get jobs. And in an increasingly global world, where, you know, work is shifting wherever there are people who can do it, if you now have a more literate workforce in, let's say, Malawi, where we are going to be, and they can get the job done in the right manner, work is going to shift there. And once it does, they will benefit economically in a very significant way. And that is likely then to even change the country. In fact, to a large extent, India is an example of the benefit of education, and then the skills, and then the economic prosperity that is a result from the skills that they've developed and are able to use to serve the world and serve themselves. So my view, that is what we should expect and plan for, and that's a very large part of why we want to do this, right?
You've mentioned the countries you're involved in, your native Pakistan, Bangladesh, Malawi. I wonder how you've chosen these three and the extent to which you have a roadmap of some sort where you anticipate going after this.
Yeah, so Pakistan was a natural because I'm originally from Pakistan. It was very easy for us to get started in Pakistan, knowing the need, knowing the place, having the network and the connections. So it is. It was just a natural. So we had, multiple factors, but we had excellent connections. It has a very high need because of a very high illiterate population, and then the third thing in Pakistan that's happening big time, and I'm very happy about, is that there is massive work going on to address illiteracy. I don't know if you were able to see this article in The Economist earlier this year, which they did this big report on Pakistan and education, and they said the headline was really they say it all. It says Pakistan is home to the most frenetic education reforms in the world. So that was, those were the combination of things that led me to start in Pakistan. Bangladesh became a choice largely because we were approached by an NGO that we liked very much, and they are operating in a very large collection of refugee camps in Bangladesh. And there are around 100,000 illiterate children in these camps. So these children presented a tremendous opportunity for us to test our ability to scale. And since our intent was phase two was a scaling phase, they were just the perfect place for us to go to. And then Malawi, we were always interested in sub-Saharan Africa because it is among the poorest regions of the world. And so we wanted to work there forever. So we decided to ask our friends at the World Bank what countries they would recommend, by and large, because we were all English-speaking, we were limited to Anglophone countries. And so they actually created a short list for us. And in that list was Malawi. And part of the reason for Malawi was also because it is the poorest country on that list, which included names like Tanzania, Kenya, Rwanda, and Ghana, and so on. So we picked Malawi through the help of the World Bank, partly informal, partly formal. We found a good NGO partner, and so we are hoping to start a project there in later this year.
Do you have a sense for how quickly you would like to go to other countries? Is your intent to roll out in a comparable pace, or to linger on these initial 3-4 time to have a chance for the pilots to be further down their maturity cycle, so to say? What are your plans?
Yeah, at this point, the plans are, as soon as we have, the plans are to get adoption by the global education funding establishment, and the people that I mentioned earlier, the World Bank, USAID, the foundation, etc. So as soon as they are able to commit money to programs such as ours, we would like to go global. And we just see that not happening for the next 18 to 24 months, just because I think we need to prove that we can scale over at least one academic cycle. And we're just in the process of doing that. So I think we will want to move as quickly as we can. The idea is to obviously be successful. So be somewhat deliberate in what we pick and where we go and what the strength of partner is, and the strength of the execution that we expect to see. But frankly, we've got more demand than we can handle today. But we hope to be, after we've proven that we can scale, we hope to be able to build a much larger cadre of implementers, both with us, but also with our partners. And then if we are able to do that successfully, hopefully we will be going global wherever there's need. Again, the beginning is probably going to be in Anglophone countries, but hopefully we'll have partners in other parts of the world who will also be able to work with us and take our model. And frankly, we have no proprietary feelings about our model. In fact, nirvana for us would be that this model become accepted and then picked up by others and then implemented by others successfully.
If there are people listening to this who are moved to join you in some way, how would you suggest they get involved, Shafiq?
I think this is, whenever you have a revolutionary movement happening, you really need thought leadership at various levels. I expect a very large part of your constituency is corporate America, perhaps the corporate world globally. And so one very good way to help is to basically begin to understand the digital revolution that's happening in learning and become, first become a believer, frankly. You need to do that. I mean, that's what we saw with the digital revolution in general, in industry in general, right? Because without that belief, without the Jack Welch's of the world, saying, I want to spend 10% of my time, me, Jack Welch, I need to spend 10% of my time on digital. That's the kind of thing we need to be thinking about. And then we need to think about where is the application? The application of learning is at every level. An enhanced way of learning applies to just basic workforce and the how educated your workforce is going to be. And it also applies to your own training, corporate training, and so on and so forth. So my first thing would be to think about it, become a believer, and then after that, begin to think about tactically, how would you support something like this? Frankly, tactically, support Teach the World by connecting us to people, by contributing to us. Obviously, we'll always very happily accept contributions. And then, in fact, we have a volunteer force that helps us with all kinds of things from search engine optimization to fundraising, etc. Strategically, I think this is perhaps the more important point. Strategically, if you are a global business, I would highly, highly recommend that from a corporate social responsibility perspective, make education, global education, and global literacy one of your top corporate priorities. And if you make it one of your top two or three CSR priorities, that alone will be a major support to this revolution.
Well, Shafiq Khan, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's so wonderful to hear about the great work that you are doing with the Teach the World Foundation. the remarkable progress that you have already made. And I, and I'm sure on behalf of the listeners, we will look forward to remaining abreast of the progress ahead, but certainly continued success.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. I really appreciate this forum and appreciate your support.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Art Hu, the CIO of Lenovo. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.